Welcome back, everyone, to 1001 Heroes, Legends, Histories, and Mysteries podcast. Today, we have with us author Stephen Hawley Martin, who has been with us before, and he's got a fantastic book out, and the book is called The Witch of Amesbury, Matriarch of an Advertising Dynasty. And I don't know if you remember Stephen's background, but he was the top guy at the Martin Agency in Richmond, and he's the guy who came up with the Geico Lizard, which we still see on TV today, and with Virginia is for Lovers, a beautiful little statement that a lot of other states have copied. But in my understanding, Stephen, you were the first with that. Is that correct?
Yeah, you know, that was quite a while ago. It was 1968. We had the Virginia tourism account, and we said, you know, we were trying to come up with a theme. We said, you know, Virginia's for mountain lovers, Virginia's for history lovers, Virginia's for beach lovers, Virginia's for theme park lovers, and finally we just decided to drop the adjective and say Virginia's for lovers, and the rest is history.
Please tell us a little bit about this story and what inspired you to write it, and who inspired you to write it?
Well, it was my mother who inspired me to write it, but it took me a long time to get around to doing it. I grew up hearing all about my ancestor, Susanna North Martin, who was accused, tried, and convicted of witchcraft back in 1692, Salem, Massachusetts, and she was hanged. You know, pictures are hung, people are hanged, and I guess my mother was kind of an early feminist in that she was a successful advertising woman, and that was not something back in the 1950s when I was growing up that women were expected to do. And so she really was caught under the collar that her husband's ancestor, Susanna, had been accused of witchcraft and hanged, and I heard about it all the time. And, you know, one of the main reasons was that this Susanna was quite a feminist in her own right for somebody back in the 17th century. She was in her 70s at the time she was accused, and yet she was able to run the farm and be successful at it. And that was something women weren't supposed to be able to do, especially one that was that old, you know, plowing the field and chopping the wood and all that. So I grew up hearing about that all my life, and a lot of stories and lore that went along with it. And I finally decided I was going to take some time, dig into the historical record, and see what I could find out for myself. Was Susanna really actually practicing witchcraft, for example? And what about the other 19 or so that were accused and executed? So it's amazing how much informable today about what went on back then. It was there, all the trial depositions, all the trial testimony, the depositions leading up to the trials, a lot of eyewitness accounts are still available. You can find all that sort of thing online, and I've read it all, and a lot of it's in this book. It focuses on my ancestor, Susanna North Martin, who was called the Witch of Amesbury because she was not from Salem. She was from a town a little ways away called Amesbury, Massachusetts. But I bring in a lot of the other characters that were part of it. So that's what got me going, was growing up with it. And I'm kind of a nonconformist because of it. I don't take what people in authority say, you know, at face value. I have to look into it and find out for myself whether it's real or not.
I found the story to be very, very interesting. You did a great deep dive in terms of the actual history. And since we're a history show, I'd kind of like you to explain to our listeners, especially our young listeners, what was the difference back then between Puritans and Christians and everybody else? What was the pressure on Puritans that might have kind of been the boiling point for all this?
Yeah, well, first off, it's important to realize that Massachusetts was a colony that was chartered by King Charles the First, who decided to let the Puritans, the Puritan sect, to have their own colony where they could go. And it was a theocracy. The Bible was the legal document that everything was based upon. Yeah, the Puritans were different than most Christians in that they believed that life was a test. Christians nowadays, most of them believe that all you need to do is believe in Jesus, believe that he lived and died for your sins and accept him as your savior, and you ride his coattails into heaven. But the Puritans didn't believe that necessarily. You had to follow all the rules. You had to do everything right if you were a Puritan. But even then, even if you did dot all the I's and cross all the T's and do what you're supposed to do, you might not make it into heaven because you weren't one of the chosen. So I believe this in the Bible, there's a piece of scripture that says, many are called, but few are chosen. And that's what they believed, that you could do it all right and still end up going to hell. And so if someone felt that they were not one of the chosen for whatever reason, then they might turn to Satan and form a pact with him, because then Satan would help them have a better life. And they might go to hell as a result of it, but at least between then and when they did, they would have a good life. So that was kind of the situation that Puritans were in. They could follow all the rules and still go to hell, or they could go over to the dark side and maybe have a good life, at least while they're here. So I think that there were some. I know that there were some who were practicing witchcraft back then. In fact, in my book, I talk about a couple of cases that took place before the witch hysteria in Massachusetts in 1692, just a few years before.
If you can recall them now, that'd be great.
Yeah, one of them, I think the one that really struck me the most was a woman named Goody Glover, and she was definitely practicing witchcraft. I mean, she didn't, make any bones about it. She called Satan her prince, and she had conversations with him. I think today that she'd probably be diagnosed as schizophrenic or something because she heard these voices. But she, for example, in her trial, the prosecutors brought in effigy dolls, voodoo dolls, you might call them, where, a witch would make one of these effigies, one of these dolls that was supposed to represent someone that she was trying to get back at, for example, and she would torture it, stick pins in it, and things like that. They brought in an effigy doll. Yeah. So in her trial, the prosecutors brought in an effigy doll and handed it to her, and she began stroking it. And when she did, one of the witnesses, one of the accusers who said that she'd been torturing him, fell on the floor in agony, in pain, because apparently he thought that that effigy doll was him and he was being tortured, which to me shows the power of belief. People back then believed in witchcraft. They believed that it was possible. They believed that there was a whole non-physical realm that existed that surrounds us, and they believed in Satan. So I think that one of the messages of my story, of my this is not a novel, it's nonfiction, is that belief is very powerful, and I think that that was a big part of what was going on back then that caused these things, because I don't think that people were necessarily faking it all the time. That's kind of what the historical record has come around to tell us, that these little girls, for example, who started the whole thing were just accusing people as a kind of power trip. But I don't think that was true. So
that's amazing. I kind of went the other direction when I was doing that story, and it looked to me like the young teens who were doing all the acting were being put up to it by their parents, who benefited or profited in some way from the death of those people. Either they didn't like them or they wanted their farm, or et cetera, et cetera. So a lot of people have made ties in that direction as well.
Yeah, I think that there may have been some of that going on. There were definitely people who benefited because of property that, you know, someone owned that they wanted, or they had a vendetta against them. But the just so our listeners know, the whole thing started because of these children who, daughters of the Reverend Paris, who mm-hmm. was the kind of preacher. The pastor for the Puritans in Salem Town was a man named Reverend Paris, P-A-R-R-I-S. And he and his wife spent a lot of time out, you know, ministering to their flock. And so they left their children, the two daughters, at home with a slave and her husband. Tituba was her name. Her husband's name was John. And they were from Barbados. They were, I believe, were Carib Indians. And Paris had and his wife had been in Barbados before, and they brought these slaves with them to Massachusetts. And Tituba entertained the children with her magic tricks. She, I suppose, had grown up, you know, with kind of a voodoo pantheistic religion, whatever the Indians there in that part of the world believed in. And so she had these magic tricks that she did. One of them would be to tell their fortune by pouring egg white into a glass of water and watching how it formed or whatever. So, and these children, the two daughters, well, I think one was 8 and the other one was 12, and they had friends over, other girls that were ranged anywhere from 8 to, I think the oldest was probably about 16, about a half a dozen of them came over and were entertained by Tituba, the slave. And they knew that they shouldn't be doing that, that it was taboo to be playing around with the occult or with anything paranormal, that it was demonic. They knew that. They were the preacher's children. And it was definitely not allowed by the Puritans. I mean, there were 3 degrees of magic. One was white magic, you know, where you use horseshoes and rabbit's feet and that sort of thing to have good luck. Then there was the kind that's just a kind of using magic to get your whatever you want. And then there's the worst kind, which is a pact with Satan. And I guess this, what Tituba was doing, didn't fall into the white magic category. It was more in the middle. And anyway, they knew they shouldn't be doing it. And they started having these symptoms where they felt they were being attacked by specters, what, like ghosts, people's spirit coming to attack them. And they, you know, would fall on the floor and writhe in pain and so forth. And so their father, the preacher, wanted to know who was doing that, who was coming to get you. And I suppose they, you know, they believed it. I don't know. I think they believed it was happening to them because, you know, why would they do that otherwise? But because they weren't out to get somebody's land or to get back at somebody. But they ended up accusing the town beggar, whose name was Sarah Good. And she was probably looked like a witch. She was, you know, going around begging, and she would stay at people's houses, and they'd, you know, get tired of her because she'd smoked a pipe and she'd set the place on fire or whatever. So anyway, that's how it all began. And it just mushroomed from that. So my analysis of it is there was at least one of the lady women who were accused, who was accused, that was probably a witch, or at least thought she was, who was using magic for her own gain. And but most of them were not. And anyway, that's kind of where I came out.
It was quite a lesson in hysteria, in mass hysteria, where reason just seems to go out the window. And there were a lot of people in positions of authority who could have straightened it out, but they preferred to be quiet. I remember there was a story of one of the judges who, just after listening to this for a few weeks, said, "I can't take this anymore," and he just walked out. He did not believe the testimony. He didn't believe what was going on. But these other judges were happy to hang him.
Yeah, they, you know, if you didn't believe it, and there were, you're right, there were people. In fact, there was a Baptist preacher who later on came to the judges and said, you guys are nuts. I mean, you can't use this kind of what they call spectral evidence, the idea that people see somebody's spirit come to them and torture them. Now, his position would have been that it could be Satan taking their form and doing it. And that you're, you know, you're accusing this person when it's probably not even their spirit. He didn't doubt the spirits were coming. He just didn't think you could use that as evidence to hang somebody. But, you know, the judges, Hawthorne was one, that I think he was the grandfather or something like that of the Hawthorne with the House of the Seven Gables. He was very willing to use the spectral evidence. And the preachers, one of the big guys was Cotton Mather. He allowed it for a while, but his father, Increase Mather, didn't really go along with it. So there was argument back and forth. And if you disagreed with these people, they might accuse you of being a witch. Or a wizard if you were a male. There were two men who were accused, and one was executed. The other was killed because they piled stones on his chest trying to get him to make a plea. Was he pleading guilty or not guilty? And they couldn't try him under their law unless he made a plea. Are you guilty or not? And he refused to say either one. And so in order to get him to make a plea, they laid him down and they started piling stones on his chest. And they piled stones on his chest until he finally said famous last words, more weight. And put the last stone on his chest and it crushed his chest and killed him. So he was never actually tried. But he was executed.
And that was the sheriff, wasn't it, who put that last stone on? I think he was standing on it at the time.
Yeah, he was a fairly, and, you know, it's just amazing that what went on, you know, back then. The people that were accused, one of the people, the guy who was hanged, the man who was hanged, had been a preacher there previously. Mm-hmm. And he had gone on and, I believe, actually lived in Maine or something like that. I've forgotten how they got him back down to Salem. But
Indian attacks, I think, brought him down the first time.
That was one of the things.
Maybe the second time as well.
Yeah, that Indians were a big problem for the people back then at that time. And that was one of the things that I think led to the hysteria that was going on around. Because the people thought the Indians, well, they were heathens. They were pantheists, I guess we would call them today. The Puritans felt they were in league with the devil, and they were having fights with them. So that was a big part of why they were so on edge, that they felt like these Indians that they were fighting with were in league with the devil, and so they were constantly fighting the devil.
We'll return to our interview with Stephen Holly Martin right after these sponsor messages.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Yeah, so Indians in league with the devil was one of the things that that caused them to be so on edge about Satan being around, causing them troubles. And it just got out of hand. There were over 150 people who were accused by the time the thing finally came to an end. And let me tell you how it came to an end, because it's interesting. According to Martin family lore, what my mother and father said was that Susanna, our ancestor, after she was hanged, that she came to the governor Phelps, and told him, her ghost came to him, her spirit came to him, and told him that his wife was going to be next. And in fact, when his wife was accused, that's when the whole thing ended. But the main argument against it, and the reason they ended it, they said, was because spectral evidence should not be allowed in court. And in fact, in England, it was not. And these people were considered themselves English. So the reason it was, I guess, is because they Massachusetts was a theocracy. And in the Bible, I think it's in Deuteronomy, which is or Exodus, where after the Ten Commandments are given. Yeah, Exodus is where they're given to Moses. After that, there are a bunch of laws that that are stated. And one of them is, thou shalt not allow a sorceress to live. And so that was their authority to execute. In the United States, or the old, in America, it wasn't in the United States yet, people were hanged. In Europe, in France, Spain, Germany, they were burned at the stake. So it was a terrible time. And I think people realized after it was over that they had made a huge, huge, huge mistake, and felt very guilty about it as a result.
And a question for you. Ever since you found out that you had a witch in the family, did that change your outlook on anything?
It absolutely did. I believe
it. Do you attend covens internationally? Or?
Well, you know, I've tried working magic, but it doesn't seem to work for me as well. But I wish I could. What it's done is caused me to be a little bit of a nonconformist. My mother was very, very beside herself about how all that had happened. And, you know, she, as I think I mentioned earlier, she was kind of an early feminist. And so she was a kind of anti-Christian fundamentalist. So I grew up that way. But what it did for me personally, I believe, is make me not always accept what people in authority said as necessarily being true. I wanted to find out for myself. And it kind of made me into a nonconformist, which I think I attribute my success in advertising and writing to that. The fact that I don't go along with the crowd. You know, I want to find something different. I want to find, you know, what the real truth is or what really works and not necessarily what conventional wisdom says it should be. And so I think to create successful advertising like the Geico Gecko or whatever, you need to have a little bit of that personality in you that says, you know, I'm not going to go along with the crowd. I'm going to do something different.
I've got a double question for you. One is, did people back in that time, in the late 17th century, did they have many things to read that weren't of a religious nature? How, what was their intelligence level? How were they able to look at events and gauge what was going on in an intelligent fashion? And behind that question, if you could explain chapter 4, Hobbes won the battle but lost the war. If you could kind of explain all that together, that would be helpful.
Yeah. One thing that I devote a little bit of time to in this book, a little bit, a few pages to chapter or so, is what the world view was in the 17th century. People back then did not understand much about science. For example, they didn't know that germs cause illness. They didn't know that germs existed. I think there was a Dutchman who was a lens grinder who spotted what he called animalcules in stagnant water, which were little tiny microscopic organisms, but he had no idea that they caused illness. And in fact, that wasn't discovered until the 19th century, the late 19th century, with Louis Pasteur and all that. So they didn't understand that germs caused illness, so they thought the devil did it, or that a witch put a curse on a cow and the cow dropped dead or stopped giving milk. They really did not understand science. And as far as Hobbes, Thomas Hobbes was an English philosopher. He wrote the Leviathan. But one of the things that he said, and there was that the only thing that exists is physical reality. He did not believe in a spiritual world. He said Hobbes' rationale was that God made the universe, and the universe is physical reality, matter, we would say in modern terminology, and that's all there is. There is no non-physical realm, no beyond the veil, no heaven, no hell. It's all here right now, and that's it. And his words really are what a lot of people believe today. Scientific materialists believe that all that exists is physical matter. It certainly was what caused one of the causes of the Age of Enlightenment, where people like Thomas Jefferson and many of the founding fathers were called deists, and they believed what Thomas Hobbes said, which is that only physical reality exists. And so their view, Thomas Jefferson's view, for example, was that God was the great clockmaker. He wound it up. He created the laws of the, you know, physical laws and so forth of the universe, gravity and all that. And he wound it up and let it go. And now all that exists is what you can see. If you can't see it under a microscope, it doesn't exist. So that was what Hobbes said. And he eventually won the battle because people believed that. I think he lost the war because we're coming around to realize that there's a lot more to reality than what you can see under a microscope. I mean, just think about it. You're probably watching this on a computer, and your computer is somehow linked to the internet through something you can't see, which is the, the waves that it picks up, just like your cell phone. You get a call and there's a signal coming into the cell phone. So there are a lot of things you can't see. And in fact, the universe is not made up of matter. It's made up of energy. E equals MC squared. And so everything is energy, and there's a lot of stuff going on that you can't see. I guess that's where I come out. And in my books, a lot of them, I investigate paranormal stuff, and I believe that there's a lot of paranormal stuff that goes on. And there was probably paranormal stuff going on in Salem back 400 years ago, or however long it's been now, back in 1692. I mean, I think there were some things that cannot be explained. Read the book and you'll see what I'm talking about.
I tend to agree with you, and you're right about the book. The book goes into a lot of that. And the real message is, and it should be for a lot of people, don't play with black magic. Don't dally with the devil. And especially, I think, when you're young, you tend to have a curiosity and you want to find out about those things, whether it be through a Ouija board or your friends who are having a Friday night seance or whatever. You don't know what you're dealing with, I think, is the most honest advice that you can give.
That's absolutely correct, John. The whole Ouija board thing, I have a little couple of paragraphs about that. I did a Google search, Ouija warning. Do it. Put that into Google. You'll see hundreds, if not thousands, of people who have had very strange and sometimes very scary experiences mm-hmm. because they were playing with Ouija boards. So,
I think not so nice spirits can attach themselves to you. You don't know how long in life they're going to stay with you, but I am a believer in that. Call me hysterical, please, if you want to, listeners. I'm hysterical when it comes to that, I guess, but it's something I just gave up on a long, long time ago in life and said, leave that door closed.
Yeah, I've had a podcast some years ago, and I interviewed two different psychiatrists who deal with spirit possession. And, what happens is when you die, most people have probably heard about or know about near-death experiences where someone pops out of their body because they're, on the operating table and their heart stopped, and they see a light and they go to the light and they're greeted by family members who've gone before and all that. Everybody knows about those stories. Well, some people who don't believe that there is an afterlife don't know to look for the light. and they become very confused, and they often stay on what is called this astral plane, that's just where we are now in the physical realm, but people can't see them or hear them, and so they will attach themselves to someone who is vulnerable, and that's what these psychiatrists treat, and they're not religious. I mean, the Catholic Church still does exorcisms, but I'm talking about psychiatrists who are able to communicate through the individual by hypnotizing them and talk. One case that stands out in my mind was a woman who started having physical problems, and the psychiatrist hypnotized her and was able to find that it was her father who had been looking for a place to be because he didn't see the light, and he kind of attached himself to his daughter, and his daughter started having the physical problems that the father had had. So the psychiatrist was able to talk to the deceased father and explain to him that he was not helping his daughter at all, and that he ought to look for the light and go to it, which he eventually did. So that's an example of something like that can happen. I mean, scientific materialists will go crazy when they hear this story, but I'm talking about a psychiatrist who is Phi Beta Kappa and, you know, and so there you go.
Stephen, for the sake of history, for the sake of our younger listeners, I'd like you to describe what took place when the hangings started in Salem. There were hangings in Boston, and then it moved to Salem. And your great-grandmother, to the nth degree, was one of those first ones. Could you describe exactly what the public and the judges did on that day of their hanging, how those people were brought to a specific spot, and what happened to them? And the reason I'm asking you this is because I want to clearly illustrate what mass hysteria can do to a population of people. That's what I'm getting at.
Yeah, the first hangings took place on July, I believe, 19th, 1692. And they were all women. I think there were five of them, including my grandmother, Susanna, seven times great-grandmother, Susanna North Martin. They were put in carts drawn by horses, taken out of Salem Village to a place called Gallows Hill, where there were trees, and they put a rope up around a branch, brought it down, and they would have a ladder and take the woman up the ladder and put tension on the rope around their neck. They would put a hood over their head, and they would kick the ladder out from under them, and they would drop. And it would, if they were lucky, it would break their neck immediately. If they weren't lucky, they would essentially be strangled to death because of the rope and, you know, cutting off their windpipe. So that's how they were executed. And then they were not allowed to be buried in the cemetery along with other people, the Christians, the Puritans. They were kind of buried in unmarked graves, and that was what they did, and it was just horrendous. I mean, people came out to watch, you know, there'd be a big crowd watching these hangings, you know, one after the other, boom, 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 and they're dangling at the end of a rope. Ugly, ugly situation.
Explain, I can't imagine. Describe what happened with Sarah Good and the legend that surrounded that.
Yeah, Sarah Good, I think we mentioned her earlier in the interview, that she was the town beggar, and she was the first one accused. And when she was taken out to be hanged, she told the preacher, who I can't remember his name right offhand, but the guy, it wasn't Reverend Paris, it was like
Nicholas Noyes, I believe.
Yeah, Nicholas Noyes. She told him that she was no more a witch than he was a wizard. And if he takes her life, he will choke on his own blood. And sure enough, 20 years later or so, when Nicholas died, he had some kind of a hemorrhage, and he indeed choked on his own blood. So, you know, there was a curse that came to be. And I think it probably because of the power of suggestion, the power of belief. Nicholas believed that that would happen to him, and it did. Amazingly so. There you go.
And then when George Burroughs, a preacher, was put to death on Gallows Hill, he went to his maker as a good Christian would wish to, you wrote. He stood straight and faced his accusers and recited the Lord's Prayer word for word from beginning to end, making no errors.
That's correct. And you know that a witch was not supposed to be able to do that. So having done that, that really put the shock in him, because a witch who was in league with the devil was not supposed to be able to even say the word God, much less recite the Lord's Prayer word for word without making a mistake. I think one of the most interesting stories in the book was when Cotton Mather took the Goodwin children, who supposedly had been cursed and put under a spell by Goodwife Glover, who was the witch who was a witch. She is the one who had the relationship with Satan, and she talked to him and so forth. Well, and he took those children into his house, and they displayed some amazing characteristics. One of them actually apparently levitated. If I don't see how that's possible, but I've heard it in other cases. So that's a story that I would that I found fascinating when I did the research on it. And Cotton Mather, he was a smart guy. He was a preacher, and he was a Puritan preacher. But he was well educated.
Yeah, he was well connected. Wasn't his father the president of Harvard?
Yeah, I believe so. And he had gone to Harvard too. And so, yeah, the Goodwin children, read about that. You'll be amazed at what happened with them.
There were a lot of different themes in your book here, themes that we didn't even come close to discussing today. But they're very interesting, listeners. Stephen takes a lot of different directions with this. It's all wrapped into a story, but he takes with an open mind. He looks at everything surrounding the hysteria. What causes it? What ended it? People's attitudes about spiritualism, about life, and death. And it's really quite interesting. I've got to admit, I could not help but make a connection between the hysteria that existed in Salem in 1692 and the hysteria that exists today with regard to COVID and people's livelihoods being taken away because they're vaxxed or unvaxxed. And this has become a dividing point between a lot of Americans. I'm not going to go deep into it, but I do think a lot of this is hysteria connected, because not all the information is getting out to people so they can make a judgment on their own. I think people should be able to make their own judgment without being forced. And that's just my opinion. But the fact that this book explains a lot to me in terms of people needing to keep an open mind and question. Don't just accept everything you hear as fact without checking it out yourself. I think that's fair enough of me to say without going any further.
I would.
Would you agree to that? And would you agree that? And would you agree that Australia is currently today Salem 1692?
I would agree 100% with that. Just think that people have gone nuts with this whole thing. I mean, really, I don't want to get into it too deeply either, because you never know that you're.
There go all your book sales, Stephen. There go all my podcast listeners, and there go your book sales. It's like I can just
but
see it
really
all sliding down the chute now.
I'm vaccinated. I got vaccinated as soon as I could. My wife was one who was a doubter about it, and she fought it for a long time. And then she realized that she needed to get the vax, or she wasn't going to be able to pursue her livelihood, which involves traveling. So she got it. But Yeah, I think there's hysteria going on that we've become divided, a divided nation because of it. And I think it's really a shame. We all need to kind of cool down and be accepting of one another, whether or not we go along with whether other people's ideas are or not. We can still all be friends, and we can respect people and, you know, follow the golden rule. Do unto others as you would have others do unto you. And that's what I live by. And I think if everybody did that, the world would be a whole lot better place.
Thank you for this wonderful book. I appreciate it. Enjoyed it a lot. I know our listeners will enjoy it too, everybody. It's The Witch of Amesbury, Matriarch of an Advertising Dynasty. Where can people get a hold of you?
Well,
and where can they find your book?
The book is on Amazon, and it's in Kindle, it's in paperback, and it's also in hardcover. And an easy way to get there would be to come to my website, shmartin.com, shmartin.com. And up at the top on the menu, there's a tab that says books. Click on that. You'll see all my books, covers of them. The name of the book is The Witch of Amesbury. It's right in the middle of that page of covers of my books. Click on the cover. It'll take you to the page on Amazon where you can maybe read the first chapter or two and decide whether or not you want to buy it. And you can buy it in in three different forms, you know. So come to my website, shmartin.com.
Well, Stephen, thank you very much. Always interesting talks with you about these books. This one, The Witch of Amesbury, absolutely excellent. Sure enjoyed it, and I enjoyed
today's
interview.
Thank you for having me, John. I appreciate it.